You're listening to KHENLP, Salida, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And this is Truth Quest with Melody. And I have a co-host this evening, Dr. Eric Carlstrom, a professor of geography at California State University at Stanislaus, with nearly 30 years of teaching experience. And his academic research has focused on using ancient soils, paleosols, and landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And I want to say we are also streamed on the internet at khen.org, and Truth Quest programs are archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. And our special guest this evening is Rosalind Peterson. And after our regular interview this evening, I'm also going to play a Catherine Albrecht interview that we did on a Friday with another program, but I thought it fits right in with Truth Quest, and it was an interview I did with her on the 15th, so those that might like to join in can listen to that afterwards. But I want to bring up our guest, Rosalind, and she is born and raised on a working on a working farm in Redwood Valley, California. The weather was foremost factor in determining whether or not our tree crops produce fruits and nuts. Between 1989 and 93, Rosalind worked as an agricultural technologist for the Mendocino County Department of Agriculture. After leaving Mendocino County, she took a position with the USDA Farm Service Agency as a program assistant in Mendocino, Sonoma, and Salinas County offices. And in 1995, she became a certified USDA Farm Service Agency crop loss adjuster, working in more than 10 counties throughout California. Many crop losses throughout the state can be attributed to weather-related causes. Rosalind has a BA degree from Sonoma State University in Environmental Studies and Planning, an ENSP with emphasis on agriculture, watersheds, climate, and crop production. And Rosalind is returning because we've had her several times in the past, and she's such a great interview and has such a wealth of information. I welcome her back. And Dr. Carlstrom, would you like to join in here? And Rosalind.
It's great to have Rosalind back. I've joined you with two interviews with Rosalind and learned a lot about the whole subject. I guess we could put it under several headings, what she calls persistent contrails and man-made clouds, other people call chemtrails, but there are other terms such as geoengineering, weather modification, environmental modification, and even weather warfare. So what we're going to be talking about overlaps with all of those topics, and Rosalind has been pioneering investigation in this field for quite some time. As you mentioned, her orientation has been towards agriculture and concern for the loss of agricultural productivity due to some of the blocking out of the sunlight that has occurred due to these man-made clouds. But let's just to start off, Rosalind, I had a chance to come and visit you and talk at length and picked up a bunch of your material. Let's begin by telling people what your websites are and how they can get access to the tremendous amount of material that you've got on the website. So as I recall, one of them is called Agriculture Coalition, agriculturedefensecoalition.com, correct?
No, but I'll take it from here if you like.
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
Okay. My name is Rosalind Peterson, and I have two websites. I have CaliforniaSkyWatch.com, which is discusses persistent jet contrails, man-made clouds, issues about weather modification, the chemicals we're seeing in our drinking water, and those type of related subjects. The other website that I have is agriculturedefensecoalition.org. Oh, mm-hmm. That is my database website. And on my database website, there's about 26,000 PDF files involving government documents, university studies. It goes into a wide range of subjects and topics, which are all interrelated in some way. It has more agriculture issues on it than it has, in other words, information about a lot of multi-topics, which take us into various areas where agriculture isn't a related topic. And what I'd like to say about the database website is that we are increasing the number of documents by another 10,000 in the next couple of weeks. We are also putting up 9,000 photographs on California Skywatch of our skies and the white haze we see in our skies, photographs that were taken by me since, and they're not doctored, but since 2002, and you'll be able to view them next month, probably in about 10 days. You'll be able to view them by date. So there'll be 2002, you go back into the late 1990s, and then you'll go each year thereafter. There will be photographs showing what our skies look like in Northern California and also when I travel in other states as well. So there's huge changes going on within those two websites, so you'll find new items all the time.
Okay. Now, in terms of your basic interest, your first interest was with agriculture and crop losses. You were a crop loss adjuster. One story you told me when I'd had a chance to visit you was what happened in the year 2007 in Mendocino County where you live. I wonder if you could tell us. Tell us that story to kind of get everybody kind of focused in on the dimensions of the problem.
Well, the dimensions of the problem involve massive tree decline. In 2007, we normally have, I'll explain the weather. The weather here is normally that we have rain and big fluffy clouds and historically, and then we had blue skies and beautiful deep blue skies, and you could see the stars so close at night that you could touch them. And in 2007, we had a period of time from December all the way to June in which we only saw blue skies all day for two or three days. And the grasses, we had enough rain, but the grasses only grew ankle height. The trees looked really weak and weren't doing well. And we had so much man-made clouds produced by these jets that what happened was is that we didn't have direct sunlight hitting the ground often at all. And so this caused us a great problem with, in other words, the native grasses not growing. People had to buy cattle feed. The plants and trees and everything didn't bloom like they used to do. They were fairly weak, and it exacerbated a lot of tree decline we've seen here in about the last 10 years. So this was a phenomenon in which the jets were over us so much that we just never saw blue sky. And it was really awful, and we think that the lack of vitamin D for people across the country and the rickets, which is getting to be epidemic, and other health effects from a lack of direct sunlight can be directly attributed to what we're seeing from this man-made cloud cover.
Well, just to kind of fill in the story a little bit, as I recall, Rosalind, you mentioned that normally the grass there grows quite tall, what, knee to waist deep?
Oh, no. Native grasses can grow 5-6 feet high.
Okay, so
in normal conditions here, and it's not unnatural to not be able to see the tops of the fence posts because the grass is so high here. So when you have ankle-high grass, then you're beginning to have a severe disruption in the amount of sunlight reaching the earth.
Yeah. Okay, so who's doing the spraying, and what are they spraying? if we could cut to the chase here, in your opinion, what is being sprayed, and how is it actually creating these man-made high clouds that are blocking so much sunlight?
Well, what is happening is that jet engine combustion produces water vapor, and the jets also produce a lot of very toxic jet fuel emissions, particulates, other things. And so what happens is that when these jets produce a lot of water vapor, this type of combustion, according to NASA, is turning into these man-made clouds, where they can persist for up to 20 hours. The water vapor, more and more of it is staying as a greenhouse gas, by the way, is staying in the atmosphere. And so when these jets come through this combustion process, they can produce these man-made clouds, and they can produce this white haze. The one jet contrail can cover, lasting up to 20 hours, can cover 4,000 kilometers. It's a very large area. And either you have cirrus, different types of cloud cover, or you have this completely white haze where everything looks just like you're in a fog, but it's a man-made produced type of fog. When people ask me what the jets are spraying, I can't say, because we know that there's rises in aluminum and barium and strontium in the drinking water supplies here in California. But the problem is that the military is using rockets to release aluminum oxide dust clouds over us. They create auroras by using barium. They create what they call night clouds, putting up rockets and canisters filled with trimethyl aluminum. And they explode those canisters, and then you get these colorful night clouds that they produce from the combustion. The military has created an artificial ionosphere. We have a real one, but they have now have the capability to create an artificial one. So we're doing a whole series of upper atmospheric tests. The CREST program puts barium, strontium, lithium, sulfur hexafluoride, which is another greenhouse gas, into canisters, and then they explode them at different heights in the atmosphere. And these produce colorful auroras that are man-made. They're not normal. And they do this over Alaska and other areas of the United States as well. So we have these studies about these upper atmospheric tests. So we can't be sure what the jets are spraying, because the readings on the ground look like they come from these other atmospheric tests where they use rockets, or they use rockets to take up canisters full of materials that they superheat and explode. So there's a wide variety of things that are going on above us. Now, the United States Air Force releases chaff and flares, and chaff is a particulate that can float in the air for up to about 20 hours at times, so it can float across several states. It interferes with Doppler radar and looks like rain patterns sometimes. And chaff is aluminum-coated fiberglass. And we feel that from what we've read and the studies that have been done, that it might not be good for human health. The EPA has announced many times that particulates cause asthma and other health problems. So this adds to the health problems that people experience. So when you ask me exactly what the jets may be doing, I'm not sure, but the military is highly engaged, along with NASA, in upper atmospheric testing and other experiments that use a whole host of chemicals which are not good for any of us.
Okay. Well, if I could just kind of quiz you on some specific things that you said.
Sure.
I've read and heard basically to alter our weather and to alter to do these geoengineering operations, which are ongoing and include numerous operations. The basic ingredients for those operations are adding chemicals, on the one hand, and adding wavelengths of electromagnetic energy. So we're dealing with combinations of those basic phenomena. Now, you mentioned night clouds, which the fancy word is noctilucent clouds, which perhaps some people remember seeing because they are natural phenomena. They do occur naturally, and yet, so what's the reason then that the military would be interested in fabricating these or making artificial noctilucent clouds, in your opinion?
Well, they're experimenting first and foremost in years past to see if they could conduct these experiments and reproduce phenomena that they're seeing in the sky and figure out how things work.
Okay.
And some of the experiments they want to know if they can do over-the-horizon communications is another example, where with the curvature of the Earth, communications would normally go in a straight line pattern. You couldn't get a communication system to curve around the Earth. And they were learning that if they put up certain types of chemicals into the atmosphere, they could cause a curvature of their communication system, so it would travel out of line of sight, essentially. And so there's a lot of discussion in military documents and abstract studies from the Pentagon, the Air Force, and the different branches of the military and universities about how to do this. So there's a lot of upper atmospheric tests that goes into how to conduct these type of experiments.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the artificial ionosphere. Perhaps we should mention that, you know, that human beings have arbitrarily subdivided our atmosphere into different levels or layers, the lower of which is the troposphere, which is the layer of our weather, which, you know, goes up about 6 to 10 miles. And then above that, you have the stratosphere, which is famous for having the quote-unquote ozone layer, or a concentration of ozone that shields us from ultraviolet radiation. And above that, you have the thermosphere, and in the upper part of that, you have what's called the ionosphere. So this is natural, and the ionosphere is comprised of electrically charged particles, or ions, which have the ability to reflect wavelengths of electromagnetic radiation, such as radio waves, back down to Earth. Now, the normal ionosphere does that for us, and we've been taking advantage of that for years and years. But the normal ionosphere has what they call upper atmospheric weather, so it's not a uniform layer of ions, and so therefore the military would like more control, and they have worked on producing these what they call ionospheric mirrors. And I suppose that's what you mean when you say artificial ionosphere. So can you take it from there and tell us what they want to do with these ionospheric mirrors?
Well, the ionospheric mirrors that they're talking about here are supposed to, in other words, have a reflective quality where they reflect their direct sunlight from reaching the Earth, away from the Earth, and back out into space. So there's these experiments that they're conducting with some of this technology are to beam certain types of beams down at the Earth as well as to reflect sunlight. So these space mirrors or different things have this effect of where you can beam something into a mirror and then it works just like a regular mirror. It can reflect that beam down into a certain spot or region of on the Earth. And if you use it in the other manner, then these space mirrors can then reflect sunlight. And they're hoping that if they reflect sunlight away from the Earth, they can reduce the amount of sunlight and cool us down. But it's highly experimental because we know that direct sunlight is needed on Earth for photosynthesis and for all plants and crops to grow.
Yeah, well, that's, I think, the very, very dangerous part of this. And, of course, let me just mention, you mentioned the CRESS program, which stands for Combined Release and Radiation Effects Satellite. And this was actually, I've got a document that I got off your website, or you gave me off your website, actually going a press kit July 1990. So this is not new technology. And again, the CRESS has to do with with rockets, isn't that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And, okay, so so we not only have planes spraying chemicals, and we're not exactly sure what the chemicals are, but we also have rockets that the military has acknowledged are definitely adding chemicals to the upper atmosphere, and then we have the wavelengths that are being generated from various installations like HAARP, the High Active Frequency Auroral Research Program. So all of these things are going on, multiple programs. In terms of what people can relate to, in terms of, I hope people are watching the sky, because if you do watch the sky on a regular basis, you see these, what Rosalind calls persistent contrails. That's what NASA calls them. A lot of people call them chemtrails. But you'll notice that these things take different forms. You notice that they stop and start. You notice that there's these weird features that come out of some of them. They kind of grow almost organically. Doesn't look like normal water vapor when you see these little bulbous protrusions coming out of the side of these things. Do you know what I'm talking about there?
Yes, I do. Yes. We have named them, named various of these contrails, so that we call them mushroom contrails because they look like they're growing little mushrooms on one side.
Yeah.
One side will have a flat line. The other side will have sort of, it looks like mushrooms growing on the ground on the other side. And what happens with this is that we believe that they're doing something. But the combinations of all of the different things that happen when we see these different types of jet trails is that we believe that they are either using something different within the formulation of the mixture that comes out of the jet, or they're adding something to it at the end, and it produces these different kinds of patterns and trails. And we think that each one has a different type in other words, it's a different type of experiment. It's not always the same type of experiment, but it's question, we have the question just what each one is and what they're trying to do with each different experiment, but we think that they're all related to, in other words, the HAARP program. They're all related to the military using the jets to change our weather, which NASA admits that they do, change the climate. And so there's a whole combination. Professor Benford has said many times that you can take a little bit of barium and a little bit of aluminum and you can produce fluffy white clouds. He's a professor at the UC Irvine. And so what happens is there's all this discussion of, well, we know we can do this or that, but that no one wants to talk about the jets as far as exactly what experiments they're performing in conjunction with other experiments. And so we're left in a gray area there. It isn't for lack of research that we're in a gray area. Many people suspect that we're definitely doing something that's abnormal. But exactly what each combination is, we're definitely not sure.
Well, I think you've made a lot of progress, Rosalind. When I visited you, you gave me some of the little flyers that you've made up, which people can actually download from your website. And one of them is very informative. It's how do you like your skies, natural or man-made? And you have a kind of the rudiments of a new cloud classification system here. Now, I've been teaching introduction to physical geography and climatology type classes for a long time, and you know, we talk about high clouds, middle clouds, and low clouds, the stratiform and the cumuliform, and you know, the basics of cloud classification. And I've got slides that I show my class that go back to the 70s and 80s, back when we did have a lot of blue skies. And I'm interested in the new cloud classification here. Just reading off this thing, here are some of the terms you have. Black trails, burst with trail that develops into spiral trail, 2-hour time lapse, extra large trail, expanded extra large trail, persisting parallels, black trail to mushroom, expanded mushroom, zigzag, twist, extra large twist, sawtooth, knots on a rope, tunnel, ocean wave, different trail types from one jet with two engines, toothpaste trail crossing, enlarging extra large plume, dissipated toothpaste trail, vibrant spectrum, which looks like it has the colors of the rainbow, highlighting artificial man-made clouds, then feather, inverted reflected ribbed trail, and not pictured, you mentioned small bursts on a rope, wingtip to wingtip jet sprays and braided trails and barbed wire trail. So you're starting to get a classification system for these artificial clouds. Again, if people are not looking up in the sky, I think they should start and maybe take some pictures of their own and watch what's going on and test Rosalind's observations against their own. We need the whole country to start looking at the sky and try to figure out the difference between what's natural, that is to say, pre-spraying, and what is now being engineered for us.
I just wanted to add that you're listening to my co-host Eric Carlstrom on Truth Quest with Melody, and our special guest this evening is Rosalind Peterson. And while we're at it, I just also wanted to bring in that we have the KHAN Halloween Bash is this Saturday, October 30th at the Steam Plant Ballroom from 7 to midnight, and this is one of the favorite fundraisers for the station, and so I just wanted to remind the audience of this. And we want to get back to talking to Rosalind on not only on the chemtrail issue, but I hope we also get into the naval testing as well. So, but go ahead, Rosalind or Eric.
Well, if I could just finish up, Rosalind, I'll just read off what's on your flyer here. It
sure.
says jets leave clearly identifiable types of contrails. Now, she's calling them persistent contrails. Others call them chemtrails. Each type persists for a specific amount of time. Some dissipate quickly, leaving only a white haze. Others turn into identifiable types of contrails. Each type of trail that persists for any length of time forms its own unique man-made cloud. And then next to that it says, NASA noted in an October 2005 newsletter that increasingly persistent contrails may turn into man-made clouds that are, quote, trapping warmth in the atmosphere and exacerbating global warming, unquote. NASA goes on to state that, quote, any change in global cloud cover may contribute to long-term changes in Earth's climate. Contrails, especially persistent contrails, represent a human-caused increase in the Earth's cloudiness and are likely to be affecting climate and ultimately our natural resources.
Yes, that's correct. And there's lots of studies and lots of, you can go to the NASA website, you can just type in man-made clouds, and you'll get a lot of research on this subject dating back many, many years, because they've been alarmed about these persisting contrails and been studying them since the late 1980s, for sure. And this is what they have come up with. However, they always tell you that they're studying commercial airlines. They never tell you that they're studying military jets. And the biggest usage here and in many areas is military. And the U.S. Air Force definitely has the largest percentage of these jets that leave these types of trails, especially in our area and in other areas across the United States, because no one else has the money. They don't have the crews, the personnel. They don't have all to keep those planes flying. They don't have, no one else would have the funding to be able to do this. So we really think that most of it has to be military, because no private company would have those types of jets, the big large ones that fly here all the time. And also they don't, and you're not going to see the skies covered when our jets are required elsewhere. And the big jets, when the Haiti earthquake happened earlier this year, all of a sudden in Northern California, all the jets disappeared. Our skies turned blue, the rains came in, the weather turned normal. It was almost like a miracle had happened, and we got our normal rainfall. And during that time, the planes were required for troops carriers, as troop carriers taking troops into Haiti. So during that time period, it was a real blessing because the jets deserted us completely, and our skies just, the blue in the skies was tremendous for a short period of time until the jets were no longer needed in Haiti and returned to this area again. So we had this respite, which was incredible. And I can tell you the blue skies and the clouds, for the first time, there wasn't a cloud layer and then a secondary cloud layer above it, and the jets weren't roaring over us in the middle of the night. It was absolutely spectacular and beautiful here.
Well, okay, so it would appear that the atmosphere, especially if you get a little bit of rain and a storm front moving in, the atmosphere can recuperate relatively quickly. Now, what about the soil and the plants? How long will it take those ecosystems to recover from the, well, whatever, 20 years of spraying that has been occurring?
Well, the thing here is that they will recover over time, but they're never going to go back to what they were before we have chemical contamination. So, in other words, the aluminum, for example, is going to stay in the soil and in the root systems for long periods of time. In other words, your skies will get clearer and we'll get more sunlight and more rain. The rainfall patterns will become normal, which will benefit native plants and crop growing, the microclimates needed for crop production. So things can change, but as long as we're keeping the jets up and we're keeping us under this man-made skies, then the recovery time will become less and less for the soils and our water supplies that are contaminated and the health of our trees. Well, and we definitely need them to stop in order to revive our trees.
Rosalind, now one thing I did notice, I had driven from Steamboat Springs down to back to my area this summer a couple of times.
Can you speak up, Melody?
Rosalind, I was noticing when I had been driving, you know, in northern Colorado through some of the major ski areas in our part of the country, and I was really taken back about with the tree damage that I saw. I mean, some of it was just from ridge to ridge. And I was thinking it was beetle kill or whatever, which, you know, that may be involved. But you just brought to mind something that I heard you even bring up in a prior interview about this aluminum. And if this is causing stress on the trees and if they're really getting hit in these areas where they're doing the geoengineering to create snow, then those areas might be the ones that are more hardest hit.
That's correct. And I do know that there's a tremendous amount of tree decline for various reasons in Colorado and other Rocky Mountain states. And they're concerned about aspens. They're concerned about all kinds of different trees. And they're saying that it's bugs and beetles. However, when you put up, according to NASA and also according to Stanford University and other studies, when you put up this man-made cloud cover, okay, and you're putting in water vapor, which is a product of aviation, all types of aviation, you begin to trap the heat in at night especially. And when you trap the heat in at night, so your temperatures are warmer, in other words, if you have clear skies, all of the heat will radiate outward, and the temperatures in the wintertime will get lower. When you cover your skies over with clouds, especially these man-made artificial clouds, you trap the heat in. And when you trap the heat in, the frost and the cold temperatures that would normally control your pests, your bugs, all of those things is not there. The temperatures don't drop to the freezing temperatures for long enough, and so therefore you start to have an increase in pests. And then as you, as the trees have less direct sunlight, as more aluminum gets into the soil, and the tree roots do absorb aluminum, especially when you have other forms of air pollution present. And as these tree roots absorb aluminum, the trees can no longer absorb enough of the nutrients and the water to survive. And it looks like they're suffering from drought. It's just like if you and I were deprived of drinking water for longer and longer periods of time, we would become more stressed and we would start to not be as healthy over time. The trees suffer this also. And so this increasing amount of aluminum in the soil and in the tree roots can also have the effect of making the trees stressed, which means that they're more susceptible to bugs and other types of pests. So you kind of have a combination going on here. And that's why we would like the jets to stop leaving these man-made clouds and in other words, the Navy stop releasing aluminum oxide dust clouds over us, because this is having an effect on the environment. And as we do that, the trees become more stressed. They have a lack of photosynthesis, so they won't grow strong and healthy and resist pests. So it's a cycle of combination of things that doesn't work well for us.
Or the biosphere. Yeah, just to add to that excellent description, Rosalind, from the point of view of all the work that's been done on global warming, this national government has pumped in billions and tens of billions, perhaps even $100 billion of research money into that. Some of this has resulted in some advances in science, certainly in advances in computer modeling. But in general, I think the consensus is that clouds have both effects, that the high clouds in particular tend to trap heat given off by the Earth, terrestrial heat, and therefore warm the temperature a little bit, whereas if you have more low clouds, that tends in general to block incoming solar radiation and cool the climate. And as you mentioned, that what we're seeing with these artificial man-made clouds, for the most part, is the artificial cirrus clouds or high clouds. And it would seem that, although, again, the clouds can have both effects, the dominant effect is to cause a warming of the temperature. Pretty interesting that NASA would admit to that. And do we have any understanding, notion of why they would want to, if global warming is a problem, which everybody's telling us it is, or at least many have been trying to tell us it is, in violation of the facts. But why the artificial clouds, as far as you can tell?
Well, I think that there's a wide variety of reasons, not all of which we know. But one of the things is that I don't think we're warming precisely everywhere. I think that a lot of the warming is taking place mostly over Alaska and the Arctic. And that's because the oil companies, in my opinion, want to extract the natural resources. The military wants to travel in those areas. And right now, since they're warmer, governments are trying to divvy up the natural resources into who gets what. And it makes an easier route, because the trips through that area, we used to have to go around. Now these passes are open almost all year round because of the melting in those areas. And the oil companies are in there for extraction of oil and natural gas. The potato farmers are moving into Alaska now to plant potatoes because the temperatures are getting more mild. So I almost think that they're creating an artificial warming in those areas. And they have to keep the cloud cover and the water vapor level up in order to sustain that, because if they allowed the clouds to dissipate and go away almost completely and have direct sunlight and cooling and heating, you would probably see a drop in temperature in the Arctic.
So you're saying they can target certain areas, and that's obvious what they're doing if they can kind of make it snow for ski areas or for certain watersheds. But I have to also wonder if, with these particular metals, that if you're saying tree up has an inability to absorb certain minerals because of the aluminum that's there, I would figure that might also be a case in humans.
Oh, the aluminum that we will ingest from drinking water supplies in the normal environment from crops and different things has to be increasing at some point because of the amount that we're getting through the atmosphere. And you see the Navy, for example, put up this aluminum oxide dust cloud on September 19th, 2009 over the East Coast. And they intend to do more, but they're talking less about it because they didn't like the reaction of the public when the public found out about the first one. So, but what's happening here is when they put this aluminum oxide dust cloud up, it's going to come back down at some point. And we're all going to be exposed to this, the soils, the waters, everything. And when we put up our trimethyl aluminum, for example, that's going to come back down too. So the pollutants that we're putting in the atmosphere from these atmospheric testing, using the rockets and using canisters and superheating them in that manner, and the aluminum-coated fiberglass that's used 500 tons or more a year is used by the military, we have to know that this is creating health problems for us and also environmental problems because of too much aluminum. So I really think that we're already seeing the effects in human health. It could be related to the increases in Alzheimer's as well. I just don't know, but I would believe that that would be true.
Well, you would find that they probably is not in their best interest to do the studies that would prove this one way or the other.
No, it wouldn't be.
Well, we interviewed Michael Murphy a couple weeks ago, and I know you know Michael Murphy. He came and interviewed you. You told me before he worked on a movie, which is now recently out, called "What in the World Are They Spraying?" With B. Edward Griffin, and it was his conclusion or thesis. And this is a movie maker from Los Angeles who kind of steeped himself in the issue, so he doesn't have your longevity in terms of studying this. But it was his conclusion that one of the goals of the spraying was to contaminate the soil with aluminum, and then Monsanto or some other GMO company could come in there with their aluminum-ready seeds, like they have now Roundup-ready seeds, which are genetically modified so that these particular plants would perhaps be the only ones that were able to grow in that type of soil. What stock do you put in that explanation?
Well, I already know that they're doing aluminum-resistant seeds and testing now to perfect some plants that would be resistant to more and more aluminum, because I feel that they're going to be using more and more in our atmosphere in the coming years. The problem with that is that you're going to have all your wildflowers, all your native plants, your trees. You cannot take every living thing on Earth and saturate it and have it survive. So just to have a few food crops survive is not going to mean that everything that we see on Earth and all the food supply will survive this. Thus, I cannot see that having a few, in other words, a few plants that are going to be aluminum resistant are going to be helpful in the scheme of things in the long term, because it will affect everything. And if we kill off our trees, if we kill off, in other words, everything that is here, your animals and ourselves, we're not going to survive either. And I don't think that much of anything will be left to survive, because the soil will be so contaminated and the water supplies will be so contaminated that survival might be extremely difficult.
Well, then you...
While we're still on this aluminum thing, Rosalind, have you seen any soil studies that would indicate that concentration of aluminum in soils has increased in the last 10 or 20 years?
Yes.
And what could you kind of summarize what you saw? I mean, what is the percentage, and in what forms are the aluminum? Is it aluminum oxides, hydroxides? What percentages are we looking at?
I'm going to have to go back to my research studies, because it's been a bit... I didn't know I was going to be asked for exact...
Well, I'm just kind of looking for a trend here. I mean, this
details.
Is the kind of thing that soil scientists analyze for. And, you know, you can get a laboratory analysis of a soil sample, and one would expect then that we could put some hard numbers on this and demonstrate a trend if indeed it's widespread, and then we could look at soil sampling from around the country, and we could see where it's most concentrated, et cetera. And we could look at the trends over the last 40 or 50 years, because this is how long we've been sampling soil. So what I'm just suggesting is that there must be some lab tests that would bear on this.
Oh, there's research data that would bear on this. I just I'd have to go run it through the search engine on my website, actually, to get the exact studies for you. But there have been soil studies along those lines, and the percentages are there is a definite increase. Plus, we're concerned it changes the pH of the soils quite a bit too, and so then you make the soils more unproductive as well. And the ones that really watch the soils a lot, I know, are the grape growers. I mean, they test all the time, and they know exactly what's in their soil almost all the time. And so their research is going to be really interesting in upcoming years to look at how their soils have changed over the years, because they almost test their soils yearly for conditioning and other purposes to grow the type of grapes and have the quality of grapes that they want. So that's another issue and another place to look for a lot of testing that's been done in more recent years.
I would think that the agricultural lobby would be fairly strong in the sense that we have some very large agribusiness interests, including the grape growers, and that they could get organized and put some pressure to bear on the government if they thought that their livelihood was threatened.
The only thing is that the jet issue remains for the Farm Bureau and other and the USDA as strictly in the hoax category, so they won't even consider discussing the subject. So it's very difficult to move them in any direction about what's going on, because if you start to talk about the jets, you go right into, oh, that's the chemtrail hoax theory, and then you're told to go away and don't bother them because this is not true. It's, you know, we're not going to follow any conspiracy theory. And this is where the breakdown becomes, is that when you use the word chemtrail, you lose certain categories of individuals and groups who don't want to discuss it. It's just like the organic growers do not want to discuss this subject. And the reason that they don't want to discuss this subject is because they would lose their organic status if there was chemicals and other things in their soils. So therefore, they are very resistant to talking about this subject or even engaging in it, because right away they would lose their organic soil status. And so they don't want to go there. So they resist this topic as heavily, even surprisingly, but as heavily as the big ag growers. So it's very difficult.
So you got a lot of different special interests that are or are not speaking up, anywhere from environmental group, agriculture, military, and the like. And in your particular area, say if you have a water problem taking place where this geoengineering could be contributing or being used in a manner that could create droughts and bring about possibly a Hegelian dialectic going on, so that they could create another problem that they could come up with a solution to. When we go back to the history of this and the geoengineering and warfare, then we might have a little more to back up the fact that these corporations could be using it against us as well as for us.
Well, that's very true. But when you look at the weather modification programs that are ongoing that NOAA lists across the United States, and even here in California and Nevada and Wyoming and Colorado and all these states, there's over 60 of them that extend all the way to Texas and in Oklahoma. and up in Montana, and then Mexico's modifying the weather as well as Canada is, especially around Alberta. So what happens with all these weather modification programs is that any person, any individual, anyone with any money, any corporation, any state, any city, any government, any agency within a government, anyone can modify the weather right now without public consent, without our prior knowledge, without any knowledge of the weather programs ongoing. And it was a real shocker here when I took some data to KTVU Oakland San Francisco Channel 2. I happened to be down doing an interview for something else, an interview in Colorado, actually. And I decided to leave my packet for the science editor at KTVU Channel 2. Well, when he got a hold of it, he called me. And at first he says, well, he says, there are no weather modification programs going in, you know, in California. And I said, well, yes, there is. And so then he did some research, and he said, yes, there's more than 30 of them. And it was a big shock when he called up the state to find out who was regulating and discovered that there were no regulations, that anyone can decide, any corporation can decide. The military is modifying our weather as well, because they talk about owning the weather as being a force multiplier. In other words, when you have a gun, they call that a force multiplier. It can deliver bullets, for example. Now, the next thing is you get a bazooka, and that force multiplier goes up in power. And you drop a bomb on someone, and the force multiplier goes up higher. So what happens is that they talk about owning the weather as a force multiplier, where they won't have to use conventional weapon systems, that if they can control your weather, they can control what you do, what other countries do. In other words, it will enforce a supreme power over everyone. So one of the things I think that the jets are doing is that they're changing our climate. NASA admits this as well, that the man-made clouds do this. And we know that weather modification programs can make fog dissipate fog. They can dissipate areas where it's going to hail. There's now hurricane modification being done by Dynamat Corporation and Bill Gates, and it's ongoing right now in conjunction with NASA. So there's private engagement and public engagement, and the people don't know that this is going on and that this is happening. And when they find out, they're kind of shocked. So we're getting hit in multiple programs on multiple layers doing different things, and that we have no laws that really govern what's going on in our atmosphere to protect us, because the atmosphere, for example, is thought of a giant physics laboratory for experimentation. And when weather modification goes on, well, we don't have to tell the public or the growers or the agricultural community either. So you have this wide variety of things that are all ongoing at the same time, and you have the cumulative and the synergistic effects of those things.
I was able to download and also get from you a number of these articles on geoengineering, one of which talks about the document you mentioned, the Air Force document published in 1996 called Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025. There was a recent meeting in Europe, I guess in Belgium, called Case Orange, and they recently talked about what's happening or acknowledged what's happening in this area of geoengineering. And they kind of summarize it here, saying that owning the weather in 2025 provides a specific timetable for the use of environmental modification techniques in cooperation with the Weather Modification Association, WMA, a business government group promoting the beneficial uses of environmental modification. And the timetable there, in 2000, introduced ionic mirrors, which I had mentioned, with a sharp increase from 2008. 2000 to 2025, use chemicals for atmospheric seeding by civilian as well as military aviation. 2004, create smart clouds through nanotechnology, with exponential increase after 2010, and then 2005 introduced carbon black dust. Okay, these are just a few of the things that are called for in this Air Force document published in 1996, which they refer to as 2025. So, yeah, it's a combination of military, civilian activities. You had mentioned Bill Gates. He's in it for a number of million dollars. Al Gore is invested in geoengineering. So what's the payoff for these individuals?
Money. Government money.
Rosalind, is the HAARP involved in any of this?
Of course.
Okay.
The HAARP relationship, no one wants to talk about it because it's heavily classified, but HAARP has to be engaged in some of this because some of their they're conducting ionospheric experiments as well. So you cannot think that some of these military applications and HAARP are not related. I do know from studies and research, which is on my website, that many universities and HAARP were involved when they put the aluminum when the Navy put the aluminum oxide dust cloud over the Eastern Seaboard, and they talked about the HAARP application there at many universities and how they were doing all these research studies after they put up this aluminum oxide dust cloud to determine what, you know, different, they were experimenting and doing different tests in order to make a determination of, in other words, these different things that they wanted to study. So we do know it's related because the government and the Navy have admitted that, and many universities have admitted that it's that they're doing this type of research.
Well, let me go ahead.
Let me follow on that. When of course HAARP is involved, then we're talking about adding electromagnetic radiation, usually extremely low frequency wavelengths, which. Again, can be bounced off the ionosphere and could be directed anywhere on the surface of the Earth because, in fact, HAARP is not the only such facility. There are others in the planet as well. But when you're talking about HAARP teaming up with a kind of a project where you, like you say, adding aluminum oxide, aren't you really talking about ionizing the atmosphere and turning it into somewhat of a plasma so then the energy that's applied can have specific effects? So that, in fact, they can move storm fronts around, they can deflect a hurricane, they can, by adding energy to particular areas, they can increase low-pressure cells, they can increase storms, they can decrease them, they can dissipate them. These would be some of the things that they can be doing by the combination of adding chemicals and electromagnetic wavelengths. Would that be correct?
Yes. That's correct.
Okay, let me go ahead and say this is KHEN LP 106.9 Salida, Colorado, and this is Truth Quest with Melody. And my co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our guest is Rosalind Peterson. And Dr. Carlstrom's website is www.naturalclimatechange.us. And you can also type in Water Watch Alliance, and you will bring up his other website. And I also wanted to mention that you can, if you have any questions for the program, we have an email that you could, khen.dj@gmail.com. And I, go ahead, either one of you.
Yeah, if I could continue with that line of thought, Rosalind, hasn't it been observed that there's an extra amount of spraying that occurs in an area before a storm front moves in? So that, therefore, they can exercise control or some more control as to how that front develops?
Yes. We always, whenever there's a report that it's going to rain, like 2 or 3 days out, we always know that that a couple of days before, that all of a sudden the jets are going to appear and hit us hard with black contrails, or they're going to hit us hard with crisscrosses and X's. They're going to hit us hard, covering our sky over, to make people think that there's a front that has arrived here early, and then we're going to have rain later. Well, sometimes we get rain, but other times it's kind of interesting. The Texas and the ranchers in the Texas Panhandle will tell you that sometimes their rain gets dissipated when this happens instead of them getting the rain that they want and need. And in our area here, we've noticed that all of a sudden they'll dry out the clouds and it won't rain here, even though they predicted a storm and 2 or 3 inches of rain, all of a sudden, zero.
I've noticed the same thing here.
And then the jets will come in and hit us hard, and then they'll back off, and a rainstorm will come in, and we will get some rain. But the workings of the clouds dissipating the rain, a lot of times in the days when I was growing up, you'd have these big fluffy clouds. They would come in, they would rain, and you could look at your barometer and see the barometer work properly, and the pressure go up and down as the storm came through. Now the barometer acts like it's not working properly because a lot of times the clouds are here. The weatherman will say there's a front here when we know that there's no front and that the barometer, the pressure in the barometer never drops. And of course we don't get any rain even though we have these, man-made clouds. So, it just depends on, which experiment they're doing at the time, whether we're going to get rain or not, rather than having normal weather systems come off the Pacific, for example, and then bring us the rain that we normally get and kind of the quantities, that we're used to having for this type of climate that we have here normally.
Rosalind, I just wanted to say that your website again is californiaskywatch.com, where people can follow up on your research. And did I hear you say another website as well?
Yeah, there's the AgricultureDefenseCoalition.org. And if you go to that site and you type in geoengineering, you will find nearly 1,000 documents, studies, the UK Parliament report on geoengineering, which came out in March 2010. You'll find information on the 3 U.S. House Science and Technology Committee hearings that were held, one last year and 2 this year. Their final report is supposed to come out in November. So, and there's a plan for global geoengineering governance in the wings here, waiting to happen, and where they're going to put chemicals and particles into the atmosphere to cool us down, like sulfur, as one example. Or there's ongoing programs now where they're putting particles into the ocean to create algae bloom. And this iron dust is devastating because these artificial algae blooms are actually harming the ocean. They do know from studies now that have been conducted, and yet they're continuing. And these companies that are doing this say, well, we're reducing global warming, and therefore we should get money from the government and cap-and-trade programs because we're reducing global warming. But they don't talk about how much they're harming the environment in the meantime, and we question how much they're reducing global warming as well.
Well, before we get into that, which I think is imperative and relates, I think, to what Melody said, the Hegelian dialectic, wasn't there a report recently of a weatherman from Seattle who resigned his job and said, hey, you just got to call it like it is. All weather now is controlled. It's scalar. He used that kind of Tesla term. It's scalar. Weather is allowed to happen, or it's modified, and there is no natural weather. You've heard of that, Rosalind?
I heard about it, but I don't have any direct confirmation.
Okay, I just saw the article.
I believe the person you're talking about is Scott Stevens, though.
Scott who?
Scott Stevens.
Scott Stevens, that sounds about right, yeah. The Hegelian dialectic, supposedly how the ruling elite manages the earth when you have a very tiny number of people that want to control the earth. You've got to fool the masses, you've got to trick them, you've got to figure out ways to manipulate them. And one way, of course, is managed conflict, the creation of a problem or the perception of a problem, and then the public is then expected to react in a certain way, and then they, the leaders, then present the solution, which, of course, is what they wanted all along. The other way to talk about that is the thesis and then the antithesis, the opposing forces yielding a synthesis. Well, I would like to just mention that, you know, having studied the whole business of man-caused global warming. Anyone who, I think, understands the long-term climate patterns knows that the amount of warming we've seen in the 20th century, which is, you know, 1 degree Fahrenheit, is well within the range of natural climate change. In fact, if we look even back 1,000 years, we see the medieval warm period was warmer than today, and people were not burning fossil fuels. And if we go back further in the past, we see many instances where the climate is much warmer, sea levels much higher. And in fact, 80% of the Earth's history, the climate's been considerably warmer, what we call hothouse conditions. So as my contention in my website, naturalclimatechange.us, is that there is no man-made global warming, that what we have is the creation of a perception of man-made global warming. And if we go back to the Hegelian dialectic, now we can start to see how this is playing out and becoming profitable, because Plan A, the solution or synthesis from Plan A is, of course, all the cap and trade and carbon taxes and Kyoto Protocol type solutions that the UN and various governments have proposed. And now there's a sizable contingent of people saying, oh gosh, Plan A didn't work. We couldn't get the politicians to agree on how to, quote unquote, fix the climate or save us from the ravages of climate change. So we better look at Plan B. Plan B, of course, being geoengineering, which turns out our military and some universities and whatnot have been doing for 60 years. So what we have then is a convenient pretext then to implement these laws, these carbon taxes, the cap and trade things, and or all these weather modification, geoengineering, weather warfare schemes. And I would just like to go on record again as saying that the whole man-caused global warming thing is pseudoscience nonsense, but it is obviously an operation, I guess we can call it an operation, because it's being affected by intelligence agencies, I think, which has multiple advantages for the ruling elite. Would you like to comment on that rather lengthy little diatribe there, Rosalind?
What happens, though, is that I think they can I think that with aviation and using the jets, they can warm certain areas. And so that's why you're seeing the warming in the Arctic, and you're seeing the warming in Alaska, and you're seeing the warming in Chile in certain areas, is because they can push with the cloud cover and the jets, they can push the climate to warm in certain areas for long, protracted periods of time just by keeping the man-made cloud cover up. And so what happens is it can appear that it's warming all over, when in actuality the temperatures are not warming all over the world. They're only warming in certain areas.
Well, in fact, if you just let me stop you there, if you're going to look at global averages, both the two main reporting stations are the Met or the Hadley Center in England, and then the Huntsville, Alabama, and both of those show a decline in global temperatures since 1998, which was an El Nino year, and in fact, fairly sharp decline since 2007. So, yeah, if you're going to talk about the world in general, it's not warming now, and certainly carbon dioxide is not the main climate driver. There's many other factors, such as the sun, which are much more important. But, yeah, locally, I suppose, it's possible that humans can have an impact. Some of the experts we've talked to, like Tim Ball, suggest that humans really can't change the climate too much. We don't have the technology, but I would agree that at the local level, we can do a lot. But in terms of the whole climate system, that may still be beyond our reach. I don't know. That's, I guess, debatable.
Rosalind?
Yes, Melody.
What part of the military do you think might be involved in this, or the heaviest involvement?
The heaviest involvement would be the Air Force. The major goal of the Air Force is full-spectrum dominance, and that includes many, many articles and research on owning the weather. So I think that of all of them, I think that the Air Force is the most heavily engaged. Not to say that the other branches of the military aren't, but I think that their access to the atmosphere, working so closely with NASA along with the Navy on certain issues, we do know that they've been Eglin Air Force Base. It's been doing lightning experiments in Florida and other areas. So we do know that their intensity in owning the weather is pretty huge, and that I think that they can do a whole lot more than we know, only because of watching the skies for so long and watching the weather patterns and how we have multiple jet streams now. And when you create an artificial ionosphere, all of this will have certain effects. And I think that they know more about it than they let on. But I think we the people are being led to believe that the weather reports and what the weather, extreme weather events and different things are just, it's just shocking and we didn't see it on our models and we didn't see this coming and we didn't know that this was going to happen. But I think that because it's more or less man-produced, even if it's from small weather modification events or large weather modification events, I think that they really know a lot more about this than we think they do.
I keep running into the Navy being a lot heavier involved in some of this than I mean, I was a bit surprised. They keep running across them. And then I'm wondering, do you see any kind of relationship with that going on with the Navy testing, the warfare testing going on in your area, or are they just totally unrelated subjects?
Oh, no, I think it's very definitely related because they're testing electromagnetic weapons, new types of over-the-horizon laser systems. The type and scope of the testing, even in their environmental impact statement, is just staggering in scope. And then when you add the classified information, and then when they talk about, well, we're doing electromagnetic warfare testing, we're putting up, dust clouds in the atmosphere, the Navy is more heavily involved with HAARP than most people realize. The Air Force and the Navy are working jointly together. And I think that this Navy warfare exercises in all the ocean areas, the Pacific, the Atlantic, and the Gulf of Mexico, and their five-year warfare expansions in all those areas is another way that they can have the Air Force and the Navy involved in all of this type of testing.
Well, if I could just read from the document called Owning the Weather in 2025 under Chapter 3, System Description. It says, our vision is that by 2025, the military could influence the weather on a mesoscale, less than 200 kilometers squared, or microscale, immediate local area, to achieve operational capabilities such as those listed in Table 1. The capability would be the synergistic result of a system consisting of one, highly trained weather force specialists, WFS, who are members of the weather force support element, two, access ports to the global weather network, so they envision this setting up this entire global weather network, where worldwide weather observations and forecasts are obtained near real time from civilian and military sources, three, a dense, highly accurate local area weather sensing and communication system, four, an advanced computer local area weather modification modeling and prediction capability within the area of responsibility, and five, proven weather modification intervention technologies, and six, a feedback capability. Now, it's kind of my observation that many of these goals have also been advanced by the enormous amount of research funding that's gone into the quote-unquote man-made global warming thing, and in terms of developing the computer models, which, of course, are not very good for estimating the climate in the future. But this also has military applications. So I would suggest that this is a little bit like the peaceful and the military uses of the atom. As we developed with heavy government subsidies the nuclear program, We had subsidizing the peaceful uses, the development of energy, alongside the military uses of hydrogen and atomic bombs. Here it seems like the equivalent almost is that the enormous amount of research money going into man-caused global warming has an indirect spinoff for these militarized programs.
Oh yes, I don't disagree with you on that. But I think our technology is much more advanced than anybody thinks because they've been experimenting with weather modification going back into the 1940s and sometimes further back. But when we were in Vietnam, if you look at some of the early photography of the jets that sprayed Agent Orange on the population of Vietnam and in those regions during the Vietnam War, the trails look quite similar to some of what we're seeing today. And the spraying technology for Agent Orange would have been the precursor for doing what we're doing now. So I think the technology there, plus the weather modification technology, because they were changing the weather using the big jets over the Ho Chi Minh Trail for years, turning it into a quagmire most of the time and having it rain there. So I think that the technology and the capability was actually developed during the Vietnam era, and that the jets were equipped, they knew how to spray. And if it's shocking to see the old footage, which I dug out and started really researching and comparing that old footage of what they were doing with the jets, and it showed the jets spraying, it showed the jets creating this weather patterns over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. It also showed the spraying of Agent Orange. And when you see this, you can just see the same technology being used now with the jets as well. It looks really similar.
That's very fascinating. So in other words, in some ways, the Vietnam War gave the military an opportunity to test technologies which they seem to be using over the United States now?
I really think so. And some of the same planes are, you know, there's a change in that. In other words, the jets are more engaged now than the prop engines are, but because most of the planes flying over and doing that kind of maneuvers in Vietnam were propeller-driven engines. So the technology has changed just because the type of airplanes being used are somewhat different these days. The other issue I can say from all of this is, and having a real discussion of this, is that what we're looking at is that the technology has come much further than they want the public to believe. And their experiments are much further along than most people really know, because it's been kept out of the public eye. You know, they keep the public fighting over political issues in other words, talking about Sarah Palin all the time, rather than talk about what the United States Navy is doing. They don't talk about weather modification programs. The weathermen don't talk about it, because if you say, well, there's an ongoing weather modification program going on right now, which is true, in Colorado and in Wyoming and in those states, then they might have to explain that someone's modifying their weather there and it's creating some havoc in those areas. Maybe the weather is much worse because of the weather modification programs ongoing there, which is true. They are currently are, just so that you know. But the meteorologists and the weather people never say to you, gee, you know, so-and-so, our state or some private company, is modifying the weather over this 10,000 square miles, so you may feel the effect of weather changes due to this modification. Well, the reason that they don't say that is because the people modifying the weather could get sued by the people on the ground who get flooded out or who have their weather modified so that they have some catastrophe. So this is why the weather modification people don't look outside, they don't look up, they tell you that persistent jet contrails are just normal weather fronts and that they're just normal clouds. And it's why their models aren't that good, because if they only look at their models, then they get shocked at something that happens because the models don't contain weather modification programs that are ongoing, for example, in California, and they don't contain information about what the jets are doing producing these man-made clouds. Now, they can see it because I've talked to the National Weather Service here in Eureka, California, and I know that they can see it because I've asked them if they can look up on their radar and see this big jet plume going across Ukiah, California, for example. And they'll say, yes, they can see it. And I said, well, that's going to turn into this huge man-made cloud. And they said, well, we don't see it as such. We just say that this is normal cloud cover. So we have a whole system of NASA and NOAA and everybody being in on the experiments, but they don't, but that's not how it's reported.
Rosalind, now are they not finding a lot more in those clouds than just metals? Are they finding organic compounds in there?
I can't say because most of the jets leaving the huge plumes are flying in military airspace. No one is up collecting samples directly into those plumes that I know of what's coming out of the jets. So I can't say because most of the samples are taken ground-based. And so if you would normally find organic materials on anything you picked up on the ground because they move around. Bacteria travel, all kinds of things travel and are airborne. So it's really hard for me to be able to make a direct connection because you can't get up into the military airspace close enough to be able to take samples.
Okay, so you're not running across other researchers that have been finding a correlation there of anything that may be attributable to these what's coming out of these planes?
A lot is attributed to the jets, but I can't make a correlation with the flight path of the jet, what they're picking up on a ground-based level as a correlation. In other words, people say, well, the jets flew over, and then we had this, and I don't know. So I kind of stay away from that discussion because I have no way of proving what the jets are spraying or dropping. Haven't seen any research, haven't seen any government documents about it, haven't seen anything. And with our government talking about all the upper atmospheric tests they're doing, it would be surprising to me if they, in other words, we know that we've been exposed to toxic chemicals. And, in other words, over San Francisco, they dumped something that made people sick. We know that we've been experimented upon before in past years. It's pretty definite and recorded history for us to have experimented on, you know, have groups or the military experiment upon us. But everyone is pretty resistant to this idea, the public in general, that anyone would do that now. Maybe they did it in the past, but they aren't going to do it now. So it's very hard for me to draw a straight correlation on who or what or why. And so that's an area that I just can't go into because I can't. Okay. I have no direct proof.
Okay, what about, are they still continuing the spraying over the areas that the Navy is having their testing?
I don't know because I'm not out over the ocean where the Navy's doing the testing, so I wouldn't know. I do know that the jets are flying over the ocean, and then a lot of times we see the man-made clouds come in or we'll see the contrails expanding as they come in over us because we're only 30 air miles from the coast. But I wouldn't know what they were doing directly over where the military is practicing. I have no idea.
Well, if I could just bring up a few points that are made in an article that got off your website, The Return of Dr. Strangelove, The Politics of Climate Engineering as a Response to Global Warming. This is that Hegelian dialectic I was trying to bring up earlier. Geoengineering is defined as, quote, the deliberate large-scale manipulation of the planetary environment to counteract anthropogenic climate change. So there it is right there. It's in the definition that all this is to counteract man-made climate change. which, if somebody bothers to study the issue, as Dr. Ball has and various of the people we've interviewed, as I have, is a lie. So, but anyway, it doesn't stop them. I mean, it didn't stop them from invading Iraq, that they didn't have weapons of mass destruction. They lied about that, and then they got their war. So this is what you call a convenient lie, which then becomes the basis for policy down through the decades, apparently. Anyway, methods fall into two types: carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere, which, of course, is ridiculous. Carbon dioxide is a miracle gas and a plant nutrient, and we're at historic lows. And then the other one is solar radiation management, aimed at reducing heat coming in or reflecting more of it out. And then it goes through all kinds of different schemes, which are all quite interesting, wild schemes. But you come down to the end of it, and you realize that there are some pretty ideologically driven people. Edward Teller was the old Dr. Strangelove, and the new iteration of him is a guy named Lowell Wood. Both of them, I believe, affiliated with Lawrence Livermore National Lab. Wood is now considered to be christened Dr. Evil by his critics. He led the group tasked with developing the technology for Ronald Reagan's ill-fated Star Wars missile shield, which included plans for an array of orbiting X-ray lasers powered by nuclear reactors. Since 1998, Wood and Teller have been promoting aerosol spraying into the stratosphere as a simple and cheap counter to global warming. Now, interestingly enough, people like Edward Teller, the guy who invented the father of the hydrogen bomb, Dr. Strangelove himself, started a petition of 31,000 scientists which said global warming is bullshit.
Watch out.
which he's, you know, basically correct. And yet, Edward Teller and his cohorts think that it doesn't matter that global warming is nonsense. We still need to modify the climate and assert our control over the natural environment. And they have allied themselves with a number of conservative think tanks in this effort, including the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, the Heartland Institute, George C. Marshall Institute, the Hoover Institute. All of these promote geoengineering. They also, ironically, and I still haven't figured it out, they also, I think, very accurately question and ridicule the whole man-caused global warming thing. But that doesn't quite follow. But then they go in the next step and say, well, we should go ahead and modify the weather anyway. Do you have a take on this, Rosalind? What's the political football being pushed around here? Do you understand it?
Yeah, I think I do. It's called cap and trade. And the climate energy legislation that has been before us that we've been fighting so hard to put a stop to is that I don't mind having an energy policy, but when you attach it to a cap and trade, there's a marvelous amount of money to be made, because the cap and trade legislation before the U.S. Senate right now, Senator Kerry, the Kerry Lieberman draft bill, that bill sets up this banking Wall Street Ponzi scheme in which you can have some sort of method, for example, ocean iron fertilization. And if you're doing that and you say it's reducing global warming, then the money that goes from this carbon tax that's included in this can get to you for promoting this enterprise of ocean iron fertilization. So there's all these venture capitalists, including Al Gore, that would benefit from this cap and trade legislation. In other words, we will tax the people with a carbon tax. We will revitalize the nuclear power energy. In other words, nuclear power. We will also take this money and feed into the oil companies and all these as clean coal, which doesn't exist at the moment. And we will also take this money and give it to venture capitalists. Now, cap and trade means we will cap pollution at a certain level. And then if you pollute above a certain level, you have to buy what they call credits and or offsets. And when you buy these offsets, it means that, for example, here in California, it's legal now for me, who has some trees on my property, to say I will sell my trees the carbon credits of my trees, because my trees hold carbon from being released into the atmosphere. And so what happens is that each of my trees is a different size and age and everything, and each of them has a value. So right now I can take public parks, or the state can, or private individuals can offer money for the carbon in my trees, and then what they do is they sell it to polluters so that polluters can continue to pollute at ever-increasing levels. So in actuality, this isn't going to reduce any type of pollution. It's just going to allow them to, through the banking system and through this venture capitalist system, that they can buy in and reap a huge profit from the American taxpayer, and also have these schemes that will generate money for these venture capitalists. So, for example, one such method can be, for example, is we will say, well, we're going to have a company that puts up this sulfur into the atmosphere to reduce global warming. And we call it geoengineering or solar radiation management, same thing, where it stops some of the sunlight reaching the earth and supposedly would cool us off. Well, our company will do this, and we will get money from this carbon tax, so that we can make a whole lot of money. So it's really a money scheme of things and how to get money from the American taxpayer into funding these schemes. And without us, if there's no carbon tax and there's no cap and trade system where they can buy and sell the right to pollute, then this whole economic system that has been built up over the last probably 5 or 6 years really seriously would collapse. And so that's why there's been this big push to pass this climate energy bill with the cap and trade in it, because that's how they would make an enormous amount of money.
Rosalind, so there's some of us that have been looking at this, that have, some of these corporations that are going in and acting like they're going into these projects that are solar or wind. It appears that some of them are getting into antiquated technologies and being able to pass these off like they're doing something great, while they're also investing elsewhere in those polluting projects, like you're saying.
Yes, that's correct, and that's exactly what they're doing. Plus the fact that, think of it, if you put sulfur into the atmosphere as a project, saying that, well, that sulfur in the atmosphere, the sulfur particles will reflect the sun from reaching the earth and cool us down, then you have air pollution costs, asthma costs, health effects, pollution of the waters, pollution of the soil. You have all these increasing health costs, which are going to be borne by the citizens. Plus, if you reduce the sunlight, then you have a lack of photosynthesis. So we're not only going to be taxed, but we're going to pay the cost of putting the sulfur up, because it's going to have these other environmental effects, which no one is talking about either.
You know, one of the other aspects, you know, with this naval testing, I'm noticing that NOAA is involved with this naval testing, rubber stamping, what's going on there, while they're also involved in this geoengineering. What is their purpose, and why would they, you know, what's going on there? Do you have any idea?
Yes. NOAA and NASA are both involved in all of this military research and testing and rockets. And a lot of the NOAA funding now comes in through, and NASA funding comes from the military. So what has happened with NOAA, and I'll give you this example from the Navy perspective, is that the Navy is funding NOAA at a high level. And during the Bush administration, a lot of Navy employees and Navy big brass went to work and were appointed into NOAA. So not only did the money begin to flow into NOAA from the Navy and other military organizations, and that's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association under Ken Salazar, the Department of Interior right now. So this money began to flow, and the personnel began to be interchanged. You know, they would leave the Navy and go into NOAA, and then they'd go back to the Navy after they leave NOAA. So they got into this kind of almost a revolving door position. And so they're cooperating agencies now. They're not, NOAA has the National Marine Fisheries Service. NOAA has under it all these agencies which are supposed to, you know, protect endangered species, all of these wonderful things and acts that we put into place so that you can't harm an endangered species. So, for example, in California, a man shot a walrus, and he's going to jail because he shot one walrus. Now, if I were to go down into any of the streams in California and disturb any of the tiny salmon population or disturb any of the little fingerlings of fish that are considered valuable, I can be fined, arrested, or both, because I disturbed five fish in some stream somewhere. Now, NOAA, in its relationship to the Navy, is still supposed to enforce the Endangered Species Act and a lot of other acts. However, they have become a cooperating agency, not an oversight agency of the Navy. So therefore, when the Navy asks NOAA for a permit to take or harm or disrupt the breeding habitats in our national marine sanctuaries and in other words, many sensitive areas in the Atlantic, the Pacific, and the Gulf of Mexico, NOAA just rubber stamps it and says, go right ahead, you can destroy 11.7 million marine mammals over the next 5 years. And that's essentially what NOAA is doing right at this moment. So with these multiple five-year warfare programs. So when you begin to look at the scope of this, you realize that once money begins to get involved and the Navy and NOAA are now cooperating agencies, NOAA is not going to say no. They're going to issue a permit here in the Northwest Training Range in California, Oregon, Idaho, and Washington to allow the Navy to destroy millions of marine mammals and their habitats.
So the people along the shores, I mean, these naval testing areas are not that far off a shore, so they've got to, are they starting to see any kind of effects on the mammals coming into the beaches and in the areas around where they're testing?
Well, they're testing now with one of the five-year warfare programs in Southern California, and we're beginning to see rare marine mammals and whales and things washing up on beaches. We're looking at starving animals now. We're looking at beachings, and the Navy, of course, denies it has any responsibilities, but we're beginning to see this encroachment. In the northern part of Oregon in the Pacific, there's new five-year warfare testing going on there, and the low flights over land areas, the noise, the bomb blasts can be heard by the people on shore, and they're being exposed to the toxic chemicals that blow in from all of this military activity. The fishermen are feeling the effects there on the fishing industry. So there's a lot of things going on. And in the entire continental United States, all the ocean areas, did you know that right now no breeding habitat, no fisheries areas which are sensitive, no marine reserves, sanctuaries are protected from encroachment by the Navy in these five-year warfare testing programs? Now, that's a real shocker because...
So where are the environmental groups in all this? They just lay down on these and then come after and pick up pet projects elsewhere?
Well, they will pick out one little thing and they'll say, well, we should save this. One group did sue only about sonar, but not about the toxic chemicals, not about the human health effects, not about fish, nothing. They sued about the sonar. And so there's a little restriction on low frequency in one place, but for the most part, they didn't do well. And there's no grassroots campaign by any environmental group that I know of that's doing grassroots. So like the NRDC will send you a note about, well, we have to save the polar bears from global warming, but they won't put out a grassroots campaign and say, look, we have to protect 11.7 million marine mammals.
Are you finding that they're monetarily tied to these situations to where they can't say anything?
I think that it would clearly disrupt their base of people that might be contributing to them, and I think that they want a seat at the negotiating table. And having a seat at the table means that they have to work with these groups rather than be in opposition to them. So therefore, just like NOAA is married to the Navy, the environmental groups, not all of them, but a lot of the bigger ones, are now engaged in being married to the corporations or making deals. And so I say to them, no, I'm not making no contributions, and you don't speak for me. So here's a statement. It's three sentences that I'm going to read that was in a letter dated June 19th, 2009, and it was to NOAA, and it was signed by six senators, including Senator Feinstein, some Oregon senators, Washington senators. There's a list, and the letter is on the website. If you go to agriculturedefensecoalition.org and you click on U.S. Navy, you can look up all this information. It's all there. And this letter reads, In many regions, the Navy plans to increase the number of its exercises or expand the areas in which they may occur, and virtually every coastal state will be affected. Some exercises may occur in the nation's most biologically sensitive marine habitats, including national marine sanctuaries and breeding habitats. In all, the Navy anticipates more than 2.3 million takes, significant disruptions in marine mammal foraging, breeding, and other essential behaviors per year, or 11.7 million takes over the course of a five-year permit. End quote. Now, a take means you can kill them, harm them, shoot them, decimate them. You can, in other words, you can do anything you want to these marine mammals using missile exercises, mind avoidance training, sonar, extended echo ranging events, and that's a lot of different types of sonar, including new laser type sonar that they have now. They're going to be using missile exercises, gunnery exercises, bombing exercises, sinking exercises, and mine warfare training. Thousands of Hellfire missiles will be blasted into our oceans. Now, nothing is going to survive in these areas, and NOAA refuses to protect any National Marine Sanctuaries or biologically sensitive areas. So it's all fair game. So when any environmental group or anyone says, oh, well, we're upset about 130 whales up here going to be interfered with in some little place because, you know, there's going to be some drilling or something, I look at this and I think, well, that's nice, but how come you're not fending off the destruction of 11.7 million marine mammals? Who's protecting public health? No one at this time. Who's protecting the fish? No one. It's not in their jurisdiction. Who's protecting, in other words, the shoreline? Who's protecting us from the toxic chemicals that are going to be used? No government agency.
So how do we know that the area in the Gulf is not already under this type of testing?
There are areas that's already under this type of testing in the Gulf of Mexico, but they want to add new five-year warfare testing to that area as well.
So does anybody suspect that possibly the core exit might be a part of this?
Oh, I don't know. I think the core exit mostly was to put the oil underwater so that people would think it went away, and they sunk it for the most part. And so now, even though the oil is still there, we can put the core exit down so we can pretend it doesn't exist. And it made skimming the oil off the surface almost entirely impossible, because once they sunk it, they couldn't skim it.
But I am hearing about a lot of health effects that may be taking place affiliated with it from those that are working around it.
Oh, the people there, some of them are so sick. I'm hearing from people all through that area about how sick they are now, and the different health effects that are going on now. It's horrible. And we're not being told, and the press has been told that they could be fined if they go in and take pictures of what's really happening, so they're really being kept out of the area altogether. And this one woman that I know flew, got someone to fly her over the Gulf, and she said there's huge patches of oil floating in the Gulf of Mexico even today. But she said the press is being restricted from going out there or taking pictures of it or talking about it at this point. So it's not going reported.
Dr. Carlson, you have any comments? Or?
No. I am obviously very interested and concerned about what's going on with the naval testing along the Pacific coast. But I don't have any more questions. If I had questions, I'd pull us back to our earlier topic. So if you have more on the Navy testing, why don't you go ahead?
No, I know that this is something that is covered on Rosalind's site, and I do feel that it's
well. Okay. I'll ask a question about the Navy testing. You were working pretty hard recently, Rosalind, up into a certain date in October, which I believe was the end of the comment period. Can you tell us a little bit about how that process has worked? There has been an attempt to go through the formalities of an environmental impact statement. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's gone? Have there been a lot of public comments? Have they been acknowledged? Have they been listened to?
The Navy figured that they would keep this so low-key and not have the major media report on this at all. It's like blacked out. No elected officials last year, when we first learned about this in February, would even talk for the record. We forced them into having another public hearing in Northern California, although they only had one for the entire Northern California region in Eureka, which wasn't heavily publicized at all by the Navy. And so we forced them into having 5.5 hours of public hearings here in Mendocino County. And most of the 5.5 hours, except for 2 or 3 people, were all opposed to having this warfare exercises off the Pacific Ocean. Oregon, people in Oregon and Washington and Idaho, because there's overland testing as well, are opposing this. But the major newspapers, except for USA Today, have not covered this story either last year or this year and refused to do so. Elected officials don't want to talk in public about it, although our Congressman Thompson, because this is an election year, has been forced to deal with this issue. We did get another extension of the Navy public comment deadline until October 24th, and then on October 25th, the Navy issued an ROD, which is a rule of decision, meaning that they're going to go ahead, full speed ahead, with the very worst of what they plan to do in our range, which is about 1,000-plus pages of horror stories about all the bombing exercises, the toxic chemicals they're going to dump in the ocean, and everything else, and the use of all of the sanctuaries and marine reserves as for warfare practice. They will almost be involved and engaged in the entire, from Southern California, which is already in operation and with a 5-year warfare program, and Hawaii, which already has its own 5-year warfare program, The Marianas Islands in the Pacific are near Guam are also going to start pretty soon as well. But our range was next in line. And now we expect that the NOAA public comment period, which ends on October 31st, in November, the 1st or 2nd of November, they will issue a permit to the Navy to allow the Navy to go ahead and take our marine mammals and start their programs. So they're going to rubber, for sure, NOAA is going to rubber stamp allowing the Navy to go ahead, and we're desperately trying to get that. Congressman Mike Thompson from California and our senators to, in other words, ask for a 60 to 90 day extension so that we can really study the issue, and find out, in other words, what the exact plans are and if NOAA will protect any of our national marine sanctuaries and biologically sensitive areas. So many county governments, all along the entire coast and in various areas, and people are up in arms and are trying to get this extension. We're also commenting publicly to NOAA, and we're writing to our elected officials. So the time for us is running out, because once NOAA goes forward and issues the Navy a permit, the Navy will go full speed ahead and into this program. And unless there's a lawsuit, which is highly expensive and very, and not only costly in time, but legal expertise to fight off a U.S. government agency that intends to do us some harm, we will then be subjected to full-scale military testing along almost the entire Pacific coast of the United States, with very few areas not directly but indirectly impacted because of the migration of the whales and different things happening here.
Well, then that also didn't, wasn't there a map that showed the eastern coast could come under the same type of testing?
Oh, yeah. If you go to my website, the agriculturedefensecoalition.org, and you click on U.S. Navy, you scroll down a bit, and you'll see the U.S. Navy map of the entire United States and its island areas. And if you look at all those small boxes, they have a whole series of kind of dark blue boxes all around the Pacific coast, all around the Atlantic seaboard, and then the Gulf of Mexico. Each one of those is what they call a range complex. Most of them have an environmental impact statement, and they're in some process or other of going into initiating another five-year warfare testing program that will cover the areas of those boxes. And there's several maps, and there's new ranges, new five-year ranges that have been introduced for both the Atlantic seaboard and a new range between the current warfare range in Hawaii and Southern California. And that will add to the number of marine mammals that will be destroyed because of the expansion of those new ranges as well.
Well, I have to say that this, what this looks like, it just kind of flies in the face of any of the environmental movement at all, because it just negates them. And at the same time, I have to wonder, you can't affect all those marine mammals without affecting the humans in a huge way. And it's almost like we're surrounded and we're under siege.
A lot of people have noted this and said, why do they have to practice in every single one of these areas? And if you read the environmental impact statements, which is monumental because each of them is about 1,000 pages or more long, but you will find that except for different types of marine mammals in different areas, the type of testing, the range of testing, the type of bombs used, the type of materials used are all the same. So it comes down to that the Navy is going to use all of this redundant testing. Their final EIS, Environmental Impact Statement, for the Northwest Range, which is us here in Northern California, for example, says that all of this, there's a statement in it, and I don't have it open to the direct quote, but what it says is that all of the things that they're going to bring in and test here have already been tested and exercises have been held in other areas. So then what is the purpose of bringing it into our area when, for example, the off the coast of Washington and in a couple of places in Oregon, they're already testing it. So now we have to have an expanded testing that has already been tested and used in other exercises and other areas. This seems like a monumental waste of money as well.
Well, we're getting down to the point of needing to bring this to a close, and I'll go ahead and Dr. Carlson, do you want to bring in have anything to say here, and then
well, Rosalind? I just have a couple points. as you mentioned, Melody, I think that this case in point demonstrates, I think, for all to see that our environmental groups have really abdicated all responsibility to carry out the mission that a lot of us thought we were helping them carry out when we sent checks their way, the Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, etc. These groups, as Rosalind mentioned, are now so intertwined with the corporatocracy, which of course is intertwined with the military-industrial media complex, that they are no longer protecting anything. They're not protecting nature. They're not protecting humans. And the other point I wanted to make is, so don't send any more money to those guys. The other point I wanted to make is coming out of the back of this article that I was quoting earlier, and I still didn't get a satisfactory answer, Rosalind, for why all these right-wing groups are opposing the IPCC, but anyway, we'll talk about that later. But the Dr. Strangelove article has a quote in here by a University of Calgary climate scientist who says more or less that the threat of unilateral action is very real for geoengineering. Any one of a dozen countries could begin it within a few years. The technology for solar radiation management is simple and cheap. All you need are planes that can fly high enough, equipped with tanks and nozzles to spray sulfuric acid or sulfur dioxide. Keith says one person could decide to do it. One person. The fact is that with the right technology, it may be cheap enough through engineering the stratosphere, which is the layer above the troposphere, that literally individual human beings may have the wealth necessary to introduce an ice age. Now, an ice age, of course, would be much, 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 much more damaging and devastating to the Earth's biosphere and human population than a tiny bit of global warming, which is generally regarded as being beneficial. So the fact that now we're in a situation where the wealth is concentrated in the hands of an extreme relative few and an extraordinary amount of wealth, and that we have people like Bill Gates and billionaire Al Gore investing in these technologies, I think this is something that we really need to be vigilant about, that the system is such now that one or two individuals could crash the entire, possibly in the future, could crash the climate. that's sobering thought.
Well, it's sobering in another way because, and I'll just say this quickly because I know our time is running out, it's sobering because Bill Gates is already planning a cloud whitening experiment off the Pacific Ocean. It is, and he's already conducting and going into hurricane modification. He's already funding some geoengineering programs. So not only do you have private individuals, but then you could have corporations doing this as well. So at this point, anybody could be doing this, but they're hoping for the funds to do it because they want to pass this cap-and-trade legislation as a climate energy bill, and that's the scary part of this legislation that's sitting there that could come up again and again in the near future.
Well, Rosalind, again, your website's californiaskywatch.com, and the other one is?
AgricultureDefenseCoalition.org.
And I really want to thank you again. You're just a wealth of information, and every time we get to talk to you, I learn a whole lot more.
thank you very much.
Yeah, and again, thank you, Rosalind, for the I've been calling you Rosalind. Melody's been calling you Rosalind. For the record, I believe it's Rosalind. Isn't that correct?
It is.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's not a problem. People do it all the time.
But anyway, it's wonderful to have a chance to talk to you. Thanks so much for all your research and your efforts, I think maybe things are breaking in your direction now with new videos being put out and more public awareness on this. And so, again, thanks for joining us.
Oh, and thank you. It's been an honor to be on the show tonight with you and Melody, and thank you very much for having me on as your guest.
Okay, well, thanks again.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Good night.